Today is Friday, April 2nd. Today's interview is with Mr. Raymond Wright of 1735 South Poole Court, Beloit, Wisconsin. We are talking with Mr. Wright in his home. My name is Clem Imhoff. Mr. Wright, let's start by having you tell us what you recall or what you were told about your family's background in Mississippi, realizing that that you won't have any personal recollection of this, but and realizing that this information will be things that your parents probably told you.
Well, there were several stories in which my dad had a very vivid recollection of some of the events that led him to leave Mississippi and come up north, and he loved to relate those things to the family. One particular one was that just before he left Mississippi, he was working for a man as a sharecropper, and he said it seems that he wanted my mother to have a dress. And so he went to this particular person who owned this farm, his boss, and asked him for the money. And he said, "Richard, you know we haven't got the money. You haven't worked enough this year, and we haven't got enough laid by in the crop to get dressed." And my dad seemed to have got awful upset, and I imagine from those things that when this opportunity came to come to Beloit, he grasped it.
So your dad apparently did have some feeling that that he was held down or oppressed in Mississippi.
He certainly did, and generally speaking, he was a gentleman, and I imagine he wasn't too quick to get upset, but this really upset him.
Now, your father's name was what?
Richard Wright.
And your mother's name?
Catherine Wright.
And her maiden name, do you recall?
Yes, her maiden name was White, mm-hmm. Catherine Ellen White. Mm-hmm. My mother was a part black and a part white.
I see. Is she related to Zachary White by any chance?
No, there was no family connection in that, no.
I see. Now, your family then came from the Pontotoc area,
yeah,
to
Pontotoc County, Pontotoc, or the city of Pontotoc, to Beloit.
Okay.
They didn't live any other place than that, as far as I am concerned.
Do you recall the name of the man that your father was sharecropping for when the story that you related took place?
It's right now, as you ask me this question, it doesn't. But I heard. But it's probably longer in the interview, I can probably recall it, mm-hmm. because I have heard him say often, the man that he worked for.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't recall it right now.
Did this particular landowner have a reputation for being especially difficult or cruel, or was this incident just an isolated?
I imagine this was just an isolated case. This particular person who possibly my dad, and by the way, my dad, as I recall him telling me, had worked for several sharecroppers. You know how it's one farm, you go from one farm to another. As your family increase and as your needs and wants get more, you leave. But I don't think that he was any particularly different than any other.
Now, were there other stories that you recall him telling you that might give us some indication of why he decided to leave Mississippi?
It seemed that at that particular time when he came concerned about possibly leaving Mississippi, he had two girls and one boy. And imagine as that family grew, and I imagine I was later on coming on, that Mississippi just didn't hold the needs that he wanted, because I imagine he was a man that, as he wasn't drafted into the world, you know, into the war, but he was a very dedicated man, and I imagine those things embodied his thinking to try to improve his family lot, and that's about the most that I can recall. And when this opportunity came to come to Beloit, and particularly Fairbanks Morris, he took advantage of it.
Did he ever express any concern for the educational opportunities that were available to his children in Mississippi?
Oh, yes. I often heard him say that his educational opportunities were very, very limited, and he certainly wanted his children to have an education. And my oldest sister, Myrtle, she went to school in the South. My brother didn't. I don't particularly know why he didn't. I don't think he was old enough when we first came up here. But my oldest sister, who was a few years older than possibly I am, went to school in the South. And as soon as they came up to Beloit, they enrolled into the public schools.
Did your dad ever give any indication that he was fearful about living in Mississippi? This comes out occasionally, I know, in talking with people, that there was really fear on the part of black people toward the system, I guess you could say, in Mississippi. Did he ever express any sentiments like that you're aware of?
No, as I told you in the first, that my dad was a very law-abiding and a very religious-minded person, and I imagine he didn't have any dealings with the establishment, as we call it, outside of his own sphere of his farm, and you know, going to town, and he always expressed opinion to, well, particularly me, that always use your manners, boy. It'll carry you a long ways. And I can remember him saying those things to me. He said, don't hurt to say yes and no, sir. He said, even to the other ones, because he said, someday they'll be saying that back to you, and you'll be liking it. So he said, and so that is impressed upon me there. So I still, to the day, still give that answer, yes sir, no sir, it don't hurt you.
Now, what did he mean, someday they'd be saying it back to you? Just what?
Well, I think that he could see way down the line that a better lot was coming for him. I imagine the group of men got together and they were dreaming about the Wisconsin, the great land of opportunity, and I think a lot of those stories went down there in regards to possibly the opportunities that lie here in Beloit, that they grasped upon and probably enlarged upon it, and he could just possibly see me possibly being someone someday.
Well, that leads into another interesting area. I'm curious about just how your parents became aware of the opportunities that existed in the North, and specifically in Beloit. Did your father or mother ever tell you just what it was that led them to come in this direction, or particularly to Beloit?
No other than what I was saying, that when the opportunity came, and the, what do you call those persons that, recruiters? When those recruiters brought the stories from the North, because I'm sure that he had no dreams of anything other than Pontotoc, where he was living. And other than the stories that they possibly, the crews, brought to him, and the opportunity that was afforded at that time, that's about all that he took advantage of.
I'm not sure we've said on tape here just exactly which year your family did come up to Beloit.
My family came here in April of 1917.
Now, you mentioned the recruiters, and I'm wondering if your father told you any specific stories about any particular encounters that he might have had with recruiters.
No, I don't recall him telling me that, and it's possibly that if it's, and I hate to make a statement that I possibly may be wrong on, but I think I've heard him mention who recruited him at that time, and it was of the Grady family, and he was in Beloit, and he did come to Ponetako as far as Memphis. I think the recruiters had problems there, and I've heard my dad just slightly say it, that a lot of times some of the fellows that came, that were coming, had to leave Pontiac and go to and get transportation out of Pontiac by other means, either trains or walking or so, to catch the train further down the line. And some of them went as far as Memphis, Tennessee to get that service. They just couldn't get it in Pontiac because, but I don't, my dad left Pontiac. I think he didn't have to slip off. He didn't owe anyone, as far as he said. And he, all that he earned was by the sweat of his brow, and he could leave there with a certain amount of dignity. Mm-hmm. And my, and as I understand it, my mother did the same thing along with the other group of ladies. I've not making this tape any longer than what it is, but I'd often have said that I'd love to see a picture, an old tin type or whatever it would be, picture of my mother and some of the other ladies of the men that were recruited to Beloit when they were getting on the train there in Pontiac, and especially when they arrived in Chicago. I've heard my mother say that they got off at the IC station there, and that might be wrong, but they had to transfer to the Union Station in Chicago. My mother, being a young woman, and particularly high-strung, when they carted them over there in a wagon, from the way I understand the story, well, they had to come up on the first level of the depot in an elevator. My mother had never seen an elevator before. And so she spoke out and said, "Look at here, they're weighing us like cattle." She used to tell that story to us kids.
That's good. I share your desire to see pictures from that time too, if there are any that exist. You indicated that your father said he didn't owe anyone, and I know today, being in debt doesn't prevent people from traveling.
No.
But apparently that was a problem for people in Mississippi.
Yes.
Did he ever say anything more about that?
No, I think only way that I can answer is that their greatest livelihood was seeing that their family was well fed and clothed, to see that they had a certain amount, and I'm pretty sure my dad was conscious of the fact that his children needed a certain amount of education, and I'm sure that he just possibly saw to it that I had gotten it if I had remained in the South. And I'm just thankful to the Lord that I had a good father like that. And I think that's what his world was pretty well centered around, because I think he was just of the average vein of man.
Now, do you recall him indicating that anyone tried to stop him from leaving Mississippi at all? Was there any attempt at all to try to stop him from leaving?
No.
Now, did you ever recall your father saying anything about the people who stayed behind in Mississippi? Did he ever express any sentiments about those who either stayed behind of their own choice or couldn't get out?
He didn't relate it to me, but I can tell you that during the time that I was growing up as a young boy, that there were men and some women that stopped in, you know, just visiting my dad in Beloit, that they had folks up here, and they would come to Beloit, and look like that would be such a happy time, see, for my mother and father to see these folks that they hadn't seen in a few years.
I gather that your family came together too. Your father apparently didn't come up. Did your father come up before the rest of your family, or did everyone come together? What was the situation?
My father came up about in the year of 1916, and I don't recall him saying just what portion, but he came up with one of the earlier recruited groups, and he was able to save a little money and lay a little bit by, I guess that's what you call it, and along with the help from Fairbanks of Advancements on checks, as they say it, he was able to visit back down there in the 1960s to see his family, and possibly sometime along, maybe I was conceived somewhere in there, but he had come back, and when he got enough together, and like I said, they came up in 17. He evidently had enough to see that my mother had transportation for her and the children. I don't know how much I imagine we were just like baggage. I don't know. I was in a baby in arms, and
so he spent several months here then, actually, before he brought the family.
Several months, yes, sir.
Now, did he ever talk about the trip to, well, you told the one story about your mother in Chicago making the changeover from the IC station to Union Station. I was wondering if he ever told anything else about the trip itself when the family actually came up to Beloit. I imagine that was quite an eventful time for them, and I wonder if they ever talked about that journey.
Well, no. No more than just what I told you.
Good. Now, do you know where your family first lived in Beloit?
Yes, they got a place out on Highland Avenue, and later on, as I got older, mother and would often ride by that house. I don't know whether I could recall now where it's at, but it was on Highland, on the west side of town here, and of course, I think they just mostly moved in with the family, and all of the earlier people all came to where it was another family settled, and they brought their family in there until they were able to procure a place of their own, you know, or somewhere else. And then they moved into South Beloit over on Gardner Street. I don't recall those places, but the place that I remember was down on, and it's a very familiar, an old street here in Beloit called Athletic Avenue. And that's where I lived and grew up as a young boy. And that's where I recall an incident where we lived right by the railroad, the Milwaukee Railroad. And one of my earlier recollections was seeing a train go by. And it was a Ku Klux Klan train that was booked for a convention in Milwaukee, as I later on learned. And I recall us little kids there standing next to the train there, and these Klansmen with these white robes and things, and they fascinated us. We didn't know what it was. And they were calling us little names, and one of them would pitch down some and say, run up to the store up there, and it was a store about by a block up there, and bring me a package of cigarettes, or bring me some tobacco, or something, recall that. And I recall that I went on an errand for one of them there, and he told me, you hurry back now. And I remember recalling just running up to that store just as fast as I could, come back to see it. When I got back, the guy didn't give me nothing.
Didn't even tip me.
Well, I don't think we were disappointed too.
You learned right then what the white robes
were. Right. I think I had a very fond recollection there. So
that's interesting. Since you brought up the whole theme of growing up in Beloit, I'm wondering what other recollections of your childhood you have on Athletic Avenue. Could you describe physically what you recall Athletic Avenue being like, first of all?
Well, Athletic Avenue bordered, as you know, right below the Milwaukee Road, and there was a large field, and of course there's a strong stadium in that area that later on they built a stadium, and I think the stadium was there, I'm pretty sure. I don't recall just what year it was built.
Now, this would have been the Beloit College?
Yes, the Beloit College Strong Stadium, as they call it. But there was a big open field there that rested between Athletic Avenue, and you cross this field, and you cross what they call the Lover's Lane, and you go up a little hill incline, you'd be on Milwaukee Road, and that's where I imagine the most wealthy of the whites lived at that time. But that was an open field, and my dad and several of the other people that lived along there raised gardens out into this area. And I can recall huge gardens and of turnips and beans. And we had to work in the garden, you know, and help sell the vegetable, you know, to get a little spending money, I imagine, for my dad now. But later on, as I recall, that area was fenced off. And I think it was fenced off until just about a few years ago, in which they are thinking about putting a park in that area now. Mm-hmm. But that was the limit of our going up on that hill. There was no further than that space between Athletic and Milwaukee Road. Because when we got up on that other, we were out of our territory. They would tell us that. Always stay in that particular area.
Who would tell you that?
My folks, my dad and mother. Now, kids have an inclination to roam, you know, and probably meddle around into things, but we knew our bounds.
Mm-hmm. Did that ever bother you that you were?
Well, it did, because I always wanted to see what was up on that hill. Later on, I lived out in that area there. Had to walk down Milwaukee Road and ride down Milwaukee Road to the area they call, Sherwood Drive out in that area. Mm-hmm. And my folks later on bought a home, and of course that was a little beyond Milwaukee Road. But Milwaukee Road was always a fascinating place for me.
Sure, I understand that. I don't want to get too far afield of the gardens. There are a couple of things I wanted to ask about that. Were the gardens primarily for home use or primarily for to make a little additional income, as you say?
They were for home use, but you know, as if you had a little surplus, you shared, and those people along there shared it. And if my dad had particular overbounds of beans, the neighbor would buy it. And like I said, the turnips, now they didn't raise turnips too much, but they would get turnips from the other persons. Turnips and turnip greens.
Now, were there, about the crops that were grown, were the same crops grown that they might have expected to grow in Pontotoc, or did they make some adjustments in their gardening habits?
No, they didn't make, as I recall, not too much adjustments, because, as I recall, beans and greens were primarily the principal eatings of our family, and imagine
there were no what we think of as southern crops like okra, black-eyed peas, or collard greens, or anything.
Well, collard greens, I imagine, could, yes.
Okay.
Anything that's that could grow in the north. Mm-hmm. But they principally stayed with what they had principally eaten in the south.
Now, you mentioned that you grew up living near the train, the railroad, the tracks. And I know when I was growing up, as a youngster in Richland Center, that had quite an influence on me. I remember playing a lot around there and being fascinated by the trains. I was wondering if the train had any particular influence on you that way. Did you interact with, was there any kind of, do you feel any interact that there was any interaction between you and the trains and the tracks and all?
Well, those tracks were quite a means of sustaining us. As I recall, before we later on moved down on what they call Race Street, and it's the area of Colby Street now, and that was a switching yard in there, and because I was growing up a pretty good sized kid then, and there was a lot of ethnic groups in there, people of Italian and Mexican and blacks in that area, and a few whites. And of course, as youngsters, we didn't know any difference, and we all played together. But out on those tracks, when they were quiet on Saturday afternoons, I can recall that we would go over there and play on those flats, jump into those sand cars. And I can tell it now, but long about those times was depression times. And if they leave a carload of coal in that particular yard, that carload of coal would be missing some of it.
Right. Right.
And they would just get enough to what they needed. It wouldn't be nothing to be sold anything, but you could see families going out there with the sacks and buckets and things and getting it. The railroad men, as we lived out on Athletic, and I don't recall too much of that, but they say would throw off coal. Honest, they would throw off coal, the firemen would, mm-hmm. to these people as they walked along, the tracks looking for coal. And I imagine they had compassion in their heart for poor people.
In talking about the train, Mr. Wright, you used the word sustained, and I was wondering if the story you just told about coal is what you meant by the railroad sustaining you or your family, or just how did you mean that word?
Yes, not in the full sense of sustaining, but they certainly were a great help. I can recall that the times were pretty hard, and men were hoboing on trains and coming through Beloit, and as I said, this was a switching yard, and this was a kind of a layover. And so naturally, being next to the railroad track, these men would bum that Colby area to these poor people there for food, white and black. And I can recall that my mother never would turn down anyone that come there and knocked on the door. We'd have poor sustaining food, but whatever we had, they were welcome to it. And I think those were just part of the times. And staying around and being around these men sometime and hear them tell these stories were very fascinating to a young boy, especially to me, sure. Where they had been, because I didn't dream where they were talking about and how far they had come and where they were going, and just drifting over life. But it never did fascinate me enough where I wanted to take it up myself.
You anticipated my next question there. That's all right. Now, you've indicated that the train was almost a source of recreation to you as a youngster, and I was wondering if there were any particular games, maybe unique games that you and your friends used to play associated with the train yards and the tracks and that sort of thing. Do you recall anything in particular?
Oh, yes. The game was that to see who could climb up on the boxcar and who could jump down further into the sand car. Some were more athletic than the other, and I think that we grew up, what little athletic ability we had there, running and jumping off of those cars into those carloads of sand. And sometimes those cars would be space quite a bit of distance between, you know how it is between the switch tracks, and we'd jump off one rung over into the other one there. Just dangerous. But I don't recall any of us ever getting hurt. Girls and boys would be out there.
Kids seem to have a special immunity from doing damn fool things, I guess. That's good. What other forms of play or games do you recall as a youngster? You know, maybe not necessarily associated with trains now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can recall, and I'm going to tell this, because it happened, and just when you were asking me, I didn't even think you were going to ask me that. I can recall that, I told you we lived in a multiple ethnic neighborhood, and there was one particular white family, and I think they were of Irish abstract. I can't recall, it was a boy right around my age, and we were all good friends. And I don't think his family particularly liked too many of us coming around there, but we got up into pretty good size. The family began to kind of, I notice, be a little harsh on this little black children. And later on, Roy was telling me, he says, when we play hide and go seek, out in the, at night in the neighborhood, says it disturbs my dad to, if some of us little blacks would be chasing the little white girls. And it didn't seem to have made any difference to us at the time, but they were telling the kids that in a way of telling us not to chase the little white girls. And I can recall that one time they were playing, and I was shut completely out of the game. In fact, I don't recall any other black being around there other than myself. And I don't know why I was standing on the sideline. And so later on, this thing dawned on me. I guess I found out in that why I was on the sidelines, because of the parents telling their children, telling them kind of slow down a little bit there, chasing.
Did there come a time when you actually couldn't, when you actually weren't allowed to play with white kids at all, or?
Well, it's just fortunate that my dad was able then, and it was getting close to the 30s, just about right before the crash, or right after the crash. My dad bought it just before the crash. My dad proceeded to change neighborhoods. He bought him a home He got him a little money together enough, how he did it, I don't know, to buy a home on Sherwood Drive. It's called the Hillcrest District now. It wasn't but about one black family in that area out there on the east side of town, and I don't think it's none out there now. But he was able to buy a home from a white man who says, my dad say he said it didn't, race didn't make any difference to him. But I changed into that neighborhood, and as I got into that neighborhood, there was, like I said, there was no blacks in that neighborhood, but I was a pretty good-sized kid then, so most of my activities then were involved in the junior high school and the upper grades, so girls and things didn't make any difference because I was going into sports anyway.
You indicated that your father was able to buy in the Hillcrest neighborhood because there was a person he bought from didn't care about race. But what about the rest of the neighborhood? Do you recall any static developing from that?
On the south of them, the south, immediate south of them, was an old Spanish War veteran. I can recall him telling me stories. And he was part Indian, but his wife was white. But with him being part Indian, I think that he just had about enough blood in him not to be a full white man, so considered as a full white man. So naturally, he was very friendly to my dad. And immediately to the north was a German family. And they were called Zolke, and as I recall, they were very, very friendly, because they were people that hadn't been from the old country too long, and I think they kind of took my dad and his family under their wings till we got established. No, we never had any racial problem in that area.
Before we get too far afield from play and recreation and that sort of thing as a youngster, I want to ask you. I think you lived near Turtle Creek, didn't you? And I wonder if that that contributed to your play and recreation.
Turtle Creek at that time was a very vital part of the group that lived along either Colby or Athletic Avenue, because it ran pure in those days, and we could swim in it at all times. And some of the areas we had places where we could dive in it. And particularly up at the junction, it's called the Milwaukee Road Junction. That's where a spur went off to Janesville and on up north, and then the other track ran on to Milwaukee. It was very fascinating because they had a bridge there, and I can recall that that was one of our great moments on a Saturday, was to catch the slow freight pulling out of the switching yard and riding it up to the switching junction there, where they had to slow down. Sometimes it didn't slow down. It was going on. The switch was open going to Milwaukee. It picked up pretty good speed there. So we got a few scars there getting off the train there to go swimming in that area of Turtle Creek there.
Any fishing?
Oh, yes. Fishing was very, very good in those days. That was a great part of, I remember my mother was an ardent fisherman. I don't think my dad did too much, but the ladies would get together and they would go up the, with the little kids tagging, with the kids tagging behind them, go up on the Turtle Creek bank, fish. I can't recall what kind of fish it was. It was an old fish that they had in there, and I don't know what they would call it today. I don't think that you would even know what I'm talking about. They call it a stone roller. Have you ever heard of anything called a stone roller?
Can you describe
it? It looked like a cross between a sucker fish, or the buffalo fish as we call it today, or the carp, but it had a very peculiar head on it and mouth. And the mouth pointed right down toward the, instead of the mouth being open, you know, it pointed right down toward the bottom of the, probably the creek. And that's the reason why they call it stone rollers, because they would take this nose and would roll these stones to lay their eggs, and then they deposit the eggs in there and roll them back on it. Now that fish, I don't know today whether it exists.
You say you called it a stone roller.
We called it a stone roller back in the days. If anyone had ever heard of that, maybe it's still a fish called that by another name.
Were they any good to eat?
No. Yeah. They were what they call scavenger. Fish, yeah. They were a scavenger fish. They were below the carp or the sucker or whatever they call the scavenger now. Mm-hmm. No, those fish were unfit to eat.
That would indicate that Turtle Creek, that there might have been some pollution in Turtle Creek. Now, you indicated before that it was a fairly clean creek, but if those scavenger fish predominated, that would indicate that it was a fairly, that it might have been somewhat polluted, do you have any recollection about that?
No, I didn't. No, I don't. It never dawned on me that that's possibly what it was. Reason why I was
maybe
saying
there just
that
wasn't enough oxygen in the water,
right.
Too much
right
foliage and stuff. I really don't
know. Right. It. I'm pretty sure Turtle Creek had pollution in it, but I was just saying that it probably don't have the
relative
pollution
to today. It wasn't
right.
Yeah. Okay. Now we haven't talked about school yet at all. Wondering about what you recall. Let's talk just a little bit about your recollections of elementary school in Beloit. What do you recall about going to elementary school here?
Elementary school in our area there, and of course of both Colby Street or Ray Street as they called it, and Athletic. There was one predominant school called Strong School. It was located up on Park Avenue now, right along in the area where they have a parochial school now. And Strong School was predominantly all black. And there was a few of the other race in there, those that lived in that area. But that school was, well, I have very fond memories for me. I was just sorry that sometimes that my children didn't get a chance to go up there, because I think they missed something by not going to Strong School. Yeah.
Why does that school have such, why do you have such fond recollections for it? What are some of the things that you remember especially?
In that school, they had what they, and I can recall the earlier part of it, they had a kindergarten. And they had what they call a portable. Now, a portable was what they would call today a kind of a preschooling or a disadvantaged schooling, you know, for disadvantaged, those slower ones. And the ones that were slower would go to the portable. And it was always the great ambition of the kids as they go along not to be put into the portable, which was located on the same ground. Because I imagine you had a certain stigma on you if you had to go to the portable. Well, I can recall that I went to kindergarten, so I bypassed the, not that I probably shouldn't have went to the portable, but I bypassed the portable school. But later on, they moved the portable off of the school grounds and made a bigger playground. And I think the playground was limited with the portable on there.
What happened to the what happened to the kids that used to go in the portable?
They just did away with that phase of the educational program. Yeah. Uh-huh. I think the portable had been in existence up quite a Well, not quite quite a long time, because as I recall, I think that the portable was mostly put in there when the blacks first started, and were primarily in that area of athletic and around in there, and some of those children, and I guess I was one of the early ones too, that didn't have the educational advantages probably in the South, and they were starting the school, were put into this portable, and it showed them how to get along with other children. And when you advance, and if you were sufficiently had the know-how, you could bypass the kindergarten. I hope that you know what I'm speaking about.
Was the kindergarten was distinct from the portable?
Right. Okay. The portable was a separate building, mm-hmm. and then the kindergarten. In other words, the school ground contained three buildings.
Did you ever have the feeling that portable was put there more or less to segregate black kids at one time, or?
Well, you could hear your folks say something along those lines, you know, and I imagine that's the reason why most of us had a stigma about going to the portable, because I don't think that I was particularly a fast learner, but I can remember that was one of my greatest, looked like achievements in my early times, was bypassing the portable. And those that did go to the portable were, well, how could I say it? You know how kids are.
Yeah, yeah.
Kids make fun of you in situations like that.
Uh-huh. Did any white kids ever get put into the portable?
I really wouldn't know, Mr. Knopf, and I imagine so. I imagine so. But as I can recall, it looked like my folks said that it was mostly put there for the blacks when they first started migrating in the earlier part of the 20th century.
Did that bother your folks? Did they seem to think that was unfair? Did they try to do anything about it?
No, they just probably accepted it as possible part of the status quo.
So when they talked about it, it was the conversation that you recall in terms of this being a form of discrimination, or just how do you recall that?
Well, possibly I was too young to tie it into that, but I imagine it was something tied to it. As I told you, as youngsters, we didn't want to go there. Yeah. Or if we went there, you were a little bit different than the other.
Mm-hmm. What do you recall that you especially liked about going to Strong School? What were some of the three of the favorite things that you remember about Strong School?
I imagine that the most outstanding thing was the large playground that they later on had there, in which they had a basketball court, and it was cemented, and that was time that we could go up there even after school and shoot baskets. And some of the ones that were my classmates later on, when we went into junior high school and high school, were very proficient in athletics, and I think that gave us a good start right there. I can also recall that at Strong School that they had a particularly friendly janitor. It was a man called Mr. Carr. That's all that I can recall, and I imagine he lived till he been dead for years, but I can recall him as an oldest man, looked like I'd ever seen, white-haired man. He was a janitor and caretaker at a strong school. And he seemed to have a particular liking to the children. And he would help us all that he could. I recall that down in the basement of Strong School, that there was a room off from the furnaces and things, in which some of the classes, and later when we got them to higher classes, would go down there to be shown slides. And that was one of the greatest things that I could see, was to go down and see these slides, because we weren't able to go to the moving picture shows too often. Yeah, right. But to be able to see these slides that the teachers would show us on, you know, in various things that they would show us down there was a great part of my liking of school, Strong School in particular.
That's interesting. That's good. Seems like kids oftentimes learn more from a janitor in school than they do from some of their teachers. I know some of the janitors I remember stand out more than some of the teachers. What about dislikes? Was there anything about the school that you really didn't like, to recall?
No, there's nothing about Strong School that I can particularly think of as dislike. I can recall, though, one time, and this is not getting away, this hasn't got nothing to do with school, and it has something to do with school, too. We were the Strong School was located right across from the Horace White Park, and the Horace White Park still stands today. And I can remember an old man. He was a white man. He was a caretaker of the Horace White Park, and of course we had to cut through the park to go home. And he particularly tell us to stay on the sidewalk, and he would chase us around if we didn't stay on it. But one particular day he asked a group of little kids going home, and I happened to be in that particular group. And I didn't know what it meant at the time. He said, "When I notice you kids going into the door over there," it was a big four doors, and what it was two doors on one side and two doors on the other side. And what the purpose was that boys are supposed to go in one door and girls go in the other door. You know how it is. That's the way they ought to do them today. But he said, "I noticed all of the black," he called it Negro at that time. "Do you Negro kids have a certain door that you have to go in?" And I guess he'd been a bit over in the park there and had noticed that all of us would go into the particular side, the right-hand side of the door. But the purpose of that door was that the girls were supposed to go on one side and the boys on the other side. He just seen all the black girls and boys, I guess. We probably didn't know any better. All go into that one side of the door. I hope that they changed us later on. I hope that that's what it was. But when he asked that question, he asked it in all sincerity. And, of course, there was this thing on me. We said, "No, we just all go on that side of the door." Now, he was a man who probably been living in Beloit and worked in that park for years and years. But he was thinking that there was a distinction between those doors.
Now, are there any teachers that you remember being especially good or influential for you?
Yes, they had a principal, and as I understand it, she passed just a few years ago, and I was just sorry that I had never got to know her any better than what I did. Her name was Mrs. Glenn, and she was a principal at Strong School. She was a strict and stern educator. That's all you could say. But, and it didn't make any difference, I don't think, to your race or anything. She was just strict. And I can remember that with her strictness that you would just buckle right down. It wouldn't be all play. And if you were halfway trying to learn, and I was kind of a slow learner, like I said, this teacher had a special class that she did it during noon hour, and I think it was in English and some math or something other, something in that area, in which some could go to her. And it was no embarrassment on my part that I went to these special classes that the principal, and I think that out of all the teachers that I've had through the public schools, that she stuck out more than any. Yeah. And this was at Strong School.
You seem to feel that you got a pretty good education there. Is that
oh, right? Yes, I certainly do.
Now, what about schoolmates? Are there any schoolmates of yours who stand out as that you were particularly close to that you'd like to talk about?
In that area that when I was going to Strong School, most of the classmates that I possibly recall were just a little bit ahead of me, and you know, the blacks in the neighborhood, and I can recall the earlier part of my kindergarten and in the lower grades that it don't seem that there were many of the other blacks, maybe just possibly during that time. My recollection would be into the junior high school areas, Mr. Miller.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you ever recall, on elementary school, at Strong School again, do you ever recall, well, first of all, at what age did you begin to go to school? What age did you go to kindergarten, were you when you went to kindergarten?
That's a good question, because I think they were taking them in that, I think you had to be six, at least six. I think it's now a little bit younger than that. But six you could, or just if you were going to have your sixth birthday. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of peculiar because my birthday comes in January. But I do recall that I was around 6 years old, because I think I was considered kind of a slow starting.
Well, you mentioned that, but you don't give any evidence of that today. You apparently caught up.
Well, I let's say this. I try to overcome it.
Now, do you ever recall being treated differently at Strong School simply because you were black? Do you ever recall anything that you interpreted that way, either at the time or later, reflecting back on it?
My greatest love was for Strong School, because I had no inkling of that, and I knew that I went through the fifth grade, and then when my folks, like I said, moved on the Sherwood Hillcrest area, that throwed me to finish my last year, or sixth year, in a predominant all-white neighborhood. And I can recall that was one of the greatest tragedies, it seems, in my life, the first day that I had to attend this all-white school. In fact, I think the records prove that I was one of the first or second blacks to ever went to Todd School in that area at that particular time, because the other ones that out there were in the junior high, I don't think they didn't have to attend that elementary school. But that seemed to have been a tragic portion of my young life, was was the day that I had to attend that school, and I can recall the principal of that school taking me to the class. And the fuck factor, I went to school that day by myself. I think I'd have had more comfort if my mother would have went with me. But I went to school by myself that day, and I was a new student, like I said, and the principal met me down at the foot of the steps and took me to her office. And I think she'd kind of heard, you know, where I was from and what I was, and going to be one of the first in that area, in that school there. And she was kind of preparing me, I imagine, but I didn't realize it at the time. But she says, "I'm taking you up," and I recall that lady's name to the day, but I can't, it slips my mind now doing this interview, just what her name was. She was the sixth grade teacher. And I walked into this class, and this class contained all of the Elites, white Elites of the town, and I could call some of them, but some of them may be listening to these tapes, to this tape. But, and they looked around at me, and I imagine I was a pathetic looking sight. But the teacher was so nice, she set me down, and she had one of the little girls pass me a paper, and she orientated me to what they were doing. And it just so happened that was work that we had been through in Strong School. Do you believe that? We had done that work. So I felt that I was going to start into a class in which I was going to be a dummy. But there I was, pretty well hip, because we were further ahead in our reader, or in our arithmetic. I think it was special education that I had at Strong School. So I got kind to be kind of a hero, because I was able to, you know, keep up with them. And on the playground, I was just a holy terror, see. Baseball hit a softball hit it over there on Emerson, or whatever you would call it. Basketball couldn't, because I was always a good-sized kid for my age.
So that turned out not to be too bad an experience.
No, that wasn't a traumatic transfer like I thought it was going to be.
Did you continue to feel isolated at Todd School simply because you were the only black person, or did
no? I think they made a special effort to, as I was only one, to make it comfortable for me. Because I remember at Valentine's Day, I'd get Valentines from all of them, and I didn't even know what it was to return them. I don't think.
Now. So you don't recall any, apparently you don't recall any forms of discrimination or anything?
No,
there.
None whatsoever.
Now, when you say they made a special effort to ease your situation, who do you mean they, and what kind of efforts were those?
I say my classmates, because I always want to be on the chosen. I'd be always the first one chosen, you know, if it was choosing up sides. And most time I was the captain of it, and I would be doing the choosing up. So those things are very important to a kid when he's growing up, to be a part of it and to almost be a leader, to take leadership in it.
Well, Mr. Wright, I see we're almost out of tape for this afternoon. We'll pick this conversation up again, though. Thank you.